ました。
Mr. Speaker, sir, I'm happy to join the Leader of the Opposition in congratulating the mover and seconder of the address. During his 29 years here, the House has listened to many notable contributions from my right honourable friend, the member for Bournemouth West. And if I may say so, his speech this afternoon was one of outstanding quality, drawing on his experience as a minister and on his conviction that free enterprise and competition are the customer's friend. I would like to pay tribute to my right honourable friend's work as chairman of the Select Committee on Home Affairs. I've also looked up his maiden speech, which he made in 1954. He spoke then of the communist threat to the free world and called on us to be a spiritually determined people. The House listened today to a speech of one of its most determined members. To my regret, my right honourable friend is not seeking re-election at the end of this Parliament, and I shall bear in mind that if this Parliament should run its full course, that, as he said, would enable him to equal the record of Bournemouth's longest-serving Member of Parliament. I'd also like to pay tribute to the speech of my honourable friend, the Member for Edinburgh South. He spoke with deep feeling about the growth of unemployment in Scotland, and I'm encouraged by his support for the measures which the government is taking to secure a sustainable growth in output. My honourable friend has a deep knowledge of the problems of Scotland, and the House listened to his speech with close attention. My honourable friend represented Berwick and East Lothian in the February 1974 Parliament. I like the story of how he was canvassing during that general election when a Labour voter said to him, "You're quite the nicest Conservative I've ever met." Then went on, "If you were the candidate, instead of that terrible belted earl, I would certainly vote for you." I turn now to the right honourable gentleman, who made his customary speech, and it is difficult to say anything more about it than that. Except perhaps two things. He mentioned the CBI survey and the CBI conference and some of their references to policies. I shall have something more to say about that later. But may I point out to him that at the recent conference of CBI, Sir Terence Beckett is reported as having said this. He contrasted the CBI package with the 9,000 million boost demanded by the Labour Party, which he said was wrong and would be disastrous for the country. It would increase inflation, reduce Britain's international competitiveness, and would blow the top off the economy. That is what the CBI thinks of the right honourable gentleman's policies, that they would be disastrous for Britain. Second point to which I will of course refer in the right honourable gentleman's speech is that he devoted a good deal of it to unemployment. And I would agree with him that unemployment is a scar on our national life. I would agree with him that the tragedy of unemployment deserves the most serious and sustained response. But it is not enough to delve deeply into the surface of things as the right honourable gentleman has a habit of doing. We owe it to the unemployed to make the most rigorous assault on tackling the causes and not just the symptoms of unemployment. And a major cause is the failure of the right honourable gentleman and his friends to attack the real roots of unemployment when they were in office. And it is no service to the unemployed to build no service to the unemployed to build false hopes by making false promises, as he did with so much of what he said today. And it is no service to them, it is no service to them to promise to spend huge sums of money which he does not possess in order to create jobs whose short-lived existence would be paid for at the expense of the jobs of some of those now in work. Because yet not at the moment. Because the extra spending he wants would have to be paid for by higher borrowing, higher interest rates, higher taxes, and inevitably by higher inflation. But employers who face higher taxes and higher interest rates often find themselves forced to shed jobs. Surely the Right Honourable Gentleman understands that. His recipe for more jobs has just three ingredients. Borrow more and more again in order to spend more, pay back the lenders in debased currency by printing money, and control nearly everything in an attempt to hide from economic reality. During his remarks, the Right Honourable Gentleman raised a number of other matters, some of which I'll try to deal with later in my speech. But first, in spite of what he said, I want to set Britain's problems in the context of some of the harsh truths of the world economic scene, which he tried to brush aside. In my, of course, if honourable members opposite do not wish to make a measured or deep analysis, they will ignore it. If they wish to deal with it, they will look at it. I come to the conclusion many times, they do not want to get rid of unemployment, they wallow in it. The 1970s worldwide saw the highest inflation rates in living memory. Even before the sharp increase in oil prices in 1973 and 1979, inflation had destroyed the fixed exchange rate system agreed at Bretton Woods. And inflation and the oil price increases ravaged the economies of Europe and North America. Growth in the major OECD countries, which in the late 1960s and early 1970s averaged 5% a year, has now fallen to nil. In fact, the recession has spared few industries and no country. Unemployment has been rising in other countries too. Indeed, the recession has hit some of them later than it hit us. Now, of course, I know, Right Honourable Gentlemen, don't want to listen to facts. They wish to fashion their policies without them. But they're going to listen to facts. At any rate, I'm going to talk facts. Whether they wish to listen is up to them.
Order. We say to the House, the Leader of the Opposition had a good hearing. Order. 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 And we might as well realise it's no good, honourable members, howling when there's an argument with which they disagree. In this place, order.
What about when there's no
order? Order. This place can't function unless we allow free speech. The Prime Minister.
In the last available 12 months, unemployment rose 51% in Canada, 45% in Germany, 40% in the Netherlands, 17% in Italy, 15% in Belgium, and 10% in the United Kingdom. The figures are the OECD. The figures are the OECD standardized basis, seasonally adjusted. But if the answer to Britain's problems were as easy as the Right Honourable Gentleman thinks, why can't the government... I prefer to make my own speech. I've not yet had much opportunity to do so. If the answers to Britain's problems were as easy as the Right Honourable Gentleman thinks, why can't the governments of those countries banish recession and unemployment? The true answer has been given by responsible governments throughout the world. It is the reflationary policies which failed last time would also fail next time. And governments in most countries are convinced that a significant part of any stimulus to demand would increase public sector deficits and dissipate itself rather quickly as an increase in inflation. So said the OECD as recently as July this year. There is no future in returning to the days when the government's reputation at home and Britain's reputation abroad was that of a spendthrift and a supplicant. There is an ever wider international understanding of the need for an unremitting fight against inflation. Nevertheless, the Right Honourable Gentleman and his Right Honourable and Honourable friends are always telling us that there is a shortage of demand in our economy. That just isn't true. Total money demand in the second quarter of this year was some 11% higher than a year earlier. Real demand was about 3% higher. But output here rose by only 1%. The difference was met by higher imports. The trouble was not shortage of demand, but the demand was not met by goods produced here. During the first 9 months of this year, out of every 100 new cars bought in Britain, 58 came from abroad. But the trouble was not shortage of demand. According to CBI estimates, had we retained the share of home and export markets that we had 12 years ago, there would now be 1.5 million more jobs in Britain. And the task of retaining those jobs lay considerably on the part of management and workforce to produce goods at the right price and right design to sell here in this country. Last year, Mr. Speaker, British industry did become more competitive. We did begin to catch up with our rivals. Our productivity increase was a record. Our pay settlements were more realistic. But this year, other countries have been improving their performance too. Well, it should spur us on to greater efforts instead of honourable members opposite urging people to increase pay claims and increase strikes. That's why it's so important to achieve lower pay settlements and to go on improving productivity. There are no rewards for doing better if others are doing better still. Now may I come to the CBI survey of which so much has been said recently. And point out, point out that the proposals of the CBI have been constructive throughout. I give way to the Right Honourable.
Before the Prime Minister leaves the question of the trade unions, and in the light of the miners' ballot, can she explain to the House why in June she said she hoped she would be able to bring forward, before the election, proposals for postal ballots? And now that that has been excluded because of its absence in the Queen's speech.
She
brought forward proposals for postal ballots in 1980. I think the Right Honourable Gentleman means secret ballots. May I tell him there's plenty of time yet? Plenty of time. The proposals of the CBI, if I may return to that, have been constructive throughout. The CBI have consistently said that they wanted inflation down. It has come down. It's at its lowest for 10 years. When the Right Honourable Gentleman's party left office, it was 10.3% and rising, notwithstanding his party's panoply of controls. It's now 7.3% and falling. And there is a good prospect of reaching 5% in the spring next year. But even a 5% annual increase in prices halves the value of money in less than 15 years. So we must get inflation down still further. CBI have also said that they wanted interest rates down. But over the past 12 months, they have come down 6.5 points. That saves industry some £1,500 million a year. CBI said they wanted help with energy costs. My Right Honourable and learned friend's budget in March, gave industry relief worth £160 million this year. CBI asked for a reduction in the Labour's national insurance surcharge. We did that too. They wanted help for small businesses. We introduced the best range of measures in the Western world. They have also Of course the Honourable Member isn't interested in good news. Not interested with the best record for getting inflation down, far better than his. A good record for getting interest rates down. A good record for helping energy prices. And if they'd lend us a hand with getting coal prices down, electricity prices would come down even further. But he's not interested in getting electricity prices down, in fact, but only trying to boost coal prices up. They've also, may I finish this section, then I will give way. I will finish this section, then give way. CBI have also urged us to restrict public spending. The government has completed this year's annual review of public expenditure. For next year, expenditure will be held to the total of £120.5 billion announced at the time of the last budget. And this includes the cost of the Falklands campaign and garrison, a continued real increase in National Health Service expenditure, an increase of over £100 million in provision for law and order, and £950 million for youth training, including our new and ambitious youth training scheme, which starts next September. The point is, we've managed to do all that and hold the public expenditure totals to the amount announced last March. That is a very considerable achievement. I give way to the Honourable Gentleman.
I'm very grateful to the Prime Minister giving way. She will recall that one of the CBI's requests was that she got the Brandt report off the shelf and gave it a dust up and had a look and see what could be done about it. Is she aware that in addition to the campaign against inflation, there is also the campaign against world poverty of 700 million people living in absolute poverty? What positive steps has she been taking on the international scene to see that something is done about that?
Mr. Speaker, and one of the ways of helping international poverty is through keeping an open trade market. And I shall come on to that very shortly. The Right Honourable Gentleman and many other honourable members over the months have urged us to increase capital expenditure, especially on construction. Well, I agree. We need more capital spending by local government and in the public sector generally. And I agree that it's vital to maintain the nation's infrastructure, its roads, its buildings, its water supply and its drains. Indeed, we are so much in agreement with these propositions that we earmarked last year and this year very large sums for precisely this purpose, all within our total public expenditure limits. What happened was that actual expenditure on water, housing, local authority capital, and nationalised industry investment fell short of our allocation by a staggering £1,600 million. It's a sorry catalogue. Housing underspend, £500 million. Local authority capital, other than housing, £200 million. Water, £70 million. Nationalised industry investment, £900 million. What a difference it would have made if these capital expenditure plans had been fulfilled. But, Mr. Speaker, most of the authorities certainly spent the money, but not on the purpose for which it was intended. Some of them sacrificed investment and therefore jobs in order to finance higher pay awards. What clearer demonstration could there be that more pay for some means fewer jobs for others? In the nationalised industries this year, we provided for capital investment of 26% greater in cash terms than was spent last year. This year, too, many of these and local authorities seem to be underspending their capital programmes. And I've therefore written to the local authority associations and to the group of nationalised industries chairmen, urging them to make full and proper use of the sums we have allocated to capital. Not, I stress, to increase their total expenditure, but to make proper provision within that total for capital investment.
If the local authorities go ahead and carry out the government's advice to increase their capital spending, will the Prime Minister guarantee that the servicing of the borrowing that is necessary will not mean that they will be penalised for overspending?
The Honourable Gentleman cannot have heard what I said. He only heard part of it. I urge them to allocate, to spend on capital, the sums allocated to capital within the total capital expenditure that we in fact had budgeted for. So, by virtue of that definition, no increase in borrowing would be required.
The Right Honourable Lady has not answered my question. Will she now say that the revenue consequences of the borrowing by the local authorities to carry out her advice will not count against spending targets and therefore will not be subject to penalty for overspending?
Honourable gentleman has put his question on a false premise. I am talking about capital expenditure within the total amount we had budgeted. No question arises, therefore, of extra expenditure. As the Honourable Gentleman knows, the local authorities, of course, can also spend some of their capital receipts from the sale of council houses if more Labour authorities would sell those council houses. But if the control of public spending is important to our economy, so too is the health of the international trading system. With around 30% of our GDP exported, we are more affected than most other major industrial countries by a deterioration in world trading conditions. When these conditions are as difficult as they are today, it's not surprising that those who seek an easy life look round for easy solutions. Don't trouble to keep our costs down, they say, just keep low-cost imports out. Protection will shield you from the chill wind of competition. But at times, the protection road is more comfortable, especially for the slow coaches. But there would be no surer way of destroying our own competitiveness. Why should companies exert themselves to reduce their costs and improve their products if those of their overseas competitors would be shut out of our domestic market? They would instead subside into a comfortable mediocrity with poor design, outmoded technology, lower production, higher costs, poorer job prospects, and the slow suffocation of effort and enterprise. That would be the effect on producers. Consumers would pay higher prices for a more restricted range of poorer quality goods. They would be losers all round. Mr. Speaker, we have and we need to have strict quotas for textiles and footwear, and we have special arrangements for steel through the community. We must have these to cushion the pace of change. But if, as a general belief, we reject protectionist measures for ourselves, equally and just as emphatically, we must oppose the efforts of those countries which raise protectionist barriers against us. Especially those countries to whose products we ourselves offer virtually an open door. The one-sided trade agreement of 1970 between the community and Spain, in which our tariff on cars is 4% and theirs is 37%, is one obvious case where we have every cause to feel aggrieved. In the case of Japan, exports to our free and open markets have doubled in the past 5 years. But few British companies, despite determined efforts and with first-class goods, which are sold well elsewhere, have managed to surmount the obstacles which make the Japanese market so difficult to penetrate. For example, we sold in 1980 £1,700 million worth of aerospace products worldwide, but only 30 million of those same products in Japan in the same period. In the vehicle components sector, we sold over £170 million worth to the United States, over £280 million worth to Germany, but only £7 million worth to Japan. This clearly is unfair and leads to a gross imbalance of trade. We shall be taking action on these matters in the special GATT meeting this month and through the economic community. We hope that those countries with unnecessarily protective markets will realize that it is their own long-term interest to have a more equitable and open trading relationship with us and with other nations. Our aim is to open up world markets, but to do that, we must fight the protectionism imposed by others. Mr. Speaker, the Right Honourable Gentleman referred to some of the legislative proposals in the gracious speech. Many of them are designed to help industry to become more competitive, more efficient, and to take advantage of the opportunities offered by new technology. The bill to denationalise British telecommunications will be the most ambitious measure of that kind ever presented to this House. It offers real opportunities for growth in the telecommunications sector. We are opening up the electricity industry to competition. We are taking steps to introduce private capital into British shipbuilders. We are encouraging British industry to exploit the latest technologies. The development of cable systems is an example, and we shall be announcing our conclusions on this and on Lord Hunt's report on cable television soon. We are also introducing legislation on data protection. It will protect individuals and will enable British firms to satisfy the international standards on data protection. The programme will also contain measures to reduce bureaucracy and the overheads on industry. A simpler system of building controls, which is what the construction industry has always wanted, a simpler structure for the water industry, and a transport bill which will establish a reasonable and lawful level of subsidy and help to keep down the burden of rates on industry. There's one other measure which I should like to mention. We shall be extending to 50,000 tenants of municipal leasehold property and to 80,000 tenants of charitable housing associations the right to buy their own homes. That will further extend the right which has already been exercised by 1/3 of a million families under this government and which is available to many more. Mr. Speaker, both management and unions are beginning to settle back into the habits of a nation with steady prices. For the first time in more than a decade, we see trade union negotiators who are willing to put their signatures to pay deals which are to last for 2 or even 3 years, because they are confident that inflation will not be allowed to get out of hand again so long as this government is in power. There can be no surer vote of confidence in our economic policy. For their part, companies are beginning to return to the capital markets to raise fixed interest stock, a practice which completely disappeared during the years of very high inflation. Many of our critics have become reluctant converts to realism. Those who only a few months ago were bandying tens of millions as the minimum scale of reflation required have been sobering up recently. Even the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Member for Stepney and Poplar, seems to have been a little less astronomical in his demands, or perhaps a little less explicit. The Social Democrats used to call for 7 billion, or was it 8 billion reflation? Now their recipe for recovery calls for a mere 3 or 4 billion. The truth is that they know it won't wash anymore. The electorate is profoundly sceptical of the big spenders, and the easy fix finds few takers. And in the trade unions, the membership has adjusted to an era of low inflation rather more quickly than some of their leaders. Time and again, the secret ballot shows that a fair and reasonable offer is likely to receive a fair and reasonable response. High and accelerating rates of inflation The nurses are being paid more under this government than they were under that of the Right Honourable Gentleman, who left them with a promise to go to Clegg, which we, in fact, honoured. Whatever the Right Honourable Gentleman said, his stewardship took us to the IMF and a supplicant, and he gave the nurses and the National Health Service a far worse deal than they are getting now. Time and again, the secret ballot shows that a fair and reasonable offer is likely to receive a fair and reasonable response by defeat. High and accelerating rates of inflation were to blame for much industrial unrest and led to so many of the unreasonable pay settlements of the last 10 years. Mr. Speaker, at no stage have I ever egged on people to make increased pay demands, nor, in fact, have I ever supported a strike unlike honourable gentlemen opposite, who do everything they can to support strikes, Nor, indeed, did one support statutory incomes and wage controls, but as I pointed out, without those, we now have lower inflation than at any time during the lifetime of the last government, and the lowest for 10 years, and we shall take it down even further. I repeat, in case right honourable gentlemen do not want to hear it, inflation is at its lowest for 10 years under a Conservative government. Interest rates are falling fast. The public deficit is under control. This government goes to the IMF as a creditor and not as a supplicant. And in fact, we have laid the foundations under which enterprise and inventive genius can make good use of the opportunities, and we have sufficient faith in British industry and in British people to believe that they will. The Honourable Gentleman wishes to make some interruption.
Will the Right Honourable Lady admit to the House that she has used unemployment to restrain wages?
It simply isn't true. What was happening, as the Honourable Gentleman knows, was that this country became competitive largely because it paid itself 90% more through the decade of the 70s for producing the same amount. And that is utterly... This country has become uncompetitive. This country has lost its competitive capacity because during the last decade, people paid themselves 90% more for the same output, while other countries overseas paid themselves amounts very similar to the increase in output. And if Right Honourable Gentlemen opposite won't recognise that, they will not recognise anything. Mr. Speaker, this government has earned for Britain a reputation abroad for resolution in maintaining and defending the values of the free world, for reliability as an ally, for determination in honouring our obligations both close to home and across the world, for the firm pursuit of our legitimate national interests. We shall maintain that reputation. The principal said, no, I intend to go on now. I have given away a great deal, and I think it's time that I went through and continued what I have to say. The principal threat to our security and our values has not changed. We remain committed to our four NATO roles, the Central Front in Europe, the Eastern Atlantic, the defence of the home base, and the strategic deterrent. And we are strengthening NOSA. We are strengthening our capability to deploy out of NATO area. No NATO government finds it easy to increase defence spending in a time of recession. We shall maintain our commitment to plan for 3% annual increases in defence spending in real terms. And we shall provide funds for the Falklands on top of that. No, sir. We shall implement NATO's decision, no, sir,
to order
missiles from late 1985 onwards if the talks in Geneva on the zero option are not successful. The voices raised in favour of unilateral disarmament are music to Soviet ears. That campaign is positively harmful to our search for a balanced reduction in the nuclear weaponry of both sides. One moment. It ignores the fact that the defence policies of the Western Alliance have preserved the peace for 37 years, and unilateralism would put at risk our security and our way of life. I give way to the Right Honourable Gentleman.
Lady, as I heard her, said that she planned to introduce cruise and Pershing from late 1985 onwards. That's 2 years later than the date she's previously fixed. Was this a slip of the tongue?
1983 onwards. If it came out as... I'm sorry, well, it should be late 1983 onwards. No, sir. I would prefer now to get on. I'm grateful to...
Order! Order! I think the Prime Minister's made it clear she's not giving way. Order! Because, like everyone else, whoever's called to speak has a right to decide when they give way. Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, those who argue that the assumptions on which we have nuclear weapons have been wrong, that the Soviet Union does not want to or could not invade Western Europe, or would not do so for fear of American retaliation, and that the nuclear deterrent is therefore not necessary, must ask themselves whether, if in government, they would take the risk of assuming that their analysis is right. This government will not put the nation's security at risk in that way.
Order. The Honourable Gentleman must understand that just by jumping up constantly, he's no more likely to get in. Well, order. Prime Minister must be allowed to continue if she's not giving way. The Prime Minister.
The behaviour of the Soviet Union continues to cloud East-West relations. The Soviet arms build-up has not stopped nor even slowed down. This year alone, 132 SS-20 warheads have been installed. Soviet forces in Afghanistan have not been withdrawn but strengthened. Martial law in Poland, far from being lifted as the regime in Warsaw has repeatedly promised, has been used to declare illegal a trade union organization which a year ago numbered 10 million members. We want to build a safer and more cooperative relationship with the countries in the eastern half of our continent. But as I said in Berlin, that will require them to have more respect for international law and human rights than we have seen in recent years. In Europe, I've had two constructive meetings...
Order. May I order? I'm sorry. Order. I have to say to the Honourable Gentleman, it's impossible for anyone to make a coherent speech if he's going to be jumping up and down all the time. And he really must not get up when it's been indicated to him that he's not going... that the Prime Minister's not giving way. I must ask him not to get up again.
I look forward to meeting President Mitterrand in Paris tomorrow. I welcome the progress that the community has recently made in settling some of its problems. We are now a short step from agreement on a common fisheries policy, which my right honourable friend, the Minister of Agriculture, has negotiated with such skill, and which our own fishing industry has welcomed. And I hope that the Danish government will now join the other 9 member states in implementing that policy. Last week, the problem of Britain's 1982 budget refunds was also satisfactorily settled. With that behind us, the government now looks to its European partners to make a serious, fresh attempt to solve the more fundamental budget problem. Equity and common sense demand that a long-term solution is found, and soon. The present situation cannot and will not continue. Mr. Speaker, the gracious speech refers to the Falklands. My right honourable friend, the Secretary of State for Defence, has just returned and has reported that the services are doing splendid work in restoring conditions of life on the islands and in constructing the facilities necessary for their permanent defence. A runway is being completed at Port Stanley to provide for an air link with Ascension and for air defence operations by Phantom aircraft. A great deal of work is in hand to ensure that the difficult living conditions which our troops had to endure since the repossession of the islands will be substantially improved before the next Falklands winter. Good progress has also been made on restoring essential services and on the immediate tasks of reconstruction. The government has been studying the recommendations in the Shackleton report for long-term development and will take decisions in the near future. The defences of the islands must be sufficient to deter and defeat any future threat. Everything possible will be done to create a secure and bright future for the islanders who suffered so much and who have earned our admiration for their courage and their resilience. Mr. Speaker, today marks the fourth gracious speech of this Parliament. Though there is a full programme of legislation, no, sir, not all of it entirely uncontroversial, I know that my right honourable friend, the Patronage Secretary, and the right honourable gentleman, the member for Bristol South, will do their utmost to get the legislative programme through expeditiously, preferably before the schools in Scotland break up for the summer holidays, which I understand is the end of June or the beginning of July. By the end of this session, the government will have completed nearly all of the programme which it placed before the British people 3.5 years ago. But there will still be plenty of work to do before this Parliament runs its full term. The programme contained in this gracious speech will continue on the consistent course which the government has followed since May 1979. The restoration of honest money and sound finance. The control of public borrowing, lower interest rates and lower inflation. A realistic link between earnings and output. The creation of conditions in which Britain will become competitive again. The introduction of private capital into the public sector. Freer and fairer world trade. Replacing monopoly by competition. The extension of home ownership. An unrelenting war on crime. A determination to strengthen our defences and to stand up for British interests throughout the world. It is a programme which deserves and which I believe will receive the support of the House. Yeah.